I wish I was in Carrickfergus, only for nights in Ballygran. I would swim over the deepest ocean, only for nights in Ballygran. But the water is wide, and I cannot swim over, and neither have I the wings to fly. I wish I meet with...
This is East End, Inc. East End community members gathered last Saturday at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor to celebrate Ireland and Irish culture.
But in Kilkenny, it is reported, the marble stone there as black as ink, with gold and silver will support her. But I sing no more till I get a drink. I'm drunk today, and I'm seldom sober, a constant rover from town to town. But I am sick now, and my days are numbered. Come all ye young rebels, and lay me down. And I am sick now, and my days are numbered. Come, O ye young rebels, and lay me down.
We heard the voice of ex-New York barkeep Peter Walsh. Next, Sigrid Meinel reads William Butler Yeats' poem, Song of the Wandering Angus.
I went out to the hazelwood because a fire was in my head, and cut and peeled a hazel wand, and hooked a berry to a thread. And when the white moths were on the wing, and moth-like stars were flickering out, I dropped the berry in a stream and caught a little silver trout. When I had laid it on the floor, I went to blow the fire aflame, but something rustled on the floor, and someone called me by my name. It had become a glimmering girl with apple blossoms in her hair, who called me by my name and ran and faded through the brightening air. Though I am old with wandering through hollow lands and hilly lands, I will find out where she has gone and kiss her lips and take her hands, and walk among dappled grass, and pluck till time and time are done the silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun.
Next, Death Transfigured Our Separation by John Donahue.
In Connemara, in the west of Ireland, that is, the graveyards are near the ocean, where there is a lot of sandy soil. To open a grave, the sod is cut into three sides, and then it's rolled back very carefully from the surface of the field. But it is not broken off. Then the coffin is put down, the prayers are said, and the grave is blessed and filled. Then the sod is rolled out over the grave again. It fits exactly over the opening. A friend of mine called it a cesarean, only in reverse. It is as if the womb of the earth, without being broken, is receiving back the individual who once left as a clay shape to live in separation above the world. It is an image of homecoming, of being taken back completely again.
Next, we hear actor Kate Muth of the group Neopolitical Cowgirls read from Rosemary Mahoney's Whoredom and Kimmage, The Private Lives of Irish Women.
The word burin, anglicized from the Irish, means a rocky place. That was putting it mildly. The burin was an awe-inspiring expanse of smooth sheets of limestone that extended for miles like near-perfect pavement. From afar, the burin looked like a blank and forbidding place, like a desert of stone, like the moon. But up close, it was crawling with life. There were foxy pine martens there, frogs, newts, lizards, badgers, stoats, sparrowhawks, kestrels, and 100 other kind of birds. In the burin, as in other parts of Ireland, there were numerous holy wells and a host of cures and superstitions that came with them. The water from holy wells was said to cure various ailments, warts, painful feet, delicate children, toothache, backache, headache, infertility, rheumatism, and even battles with death. But the great majority of the wells had a power to cure eye illnesses. I mentioned to Giles and Francis that I had visited a holy well just up the road in Kilnaboy, and Eamon the butcher shouted in a bored way, "What's that one for? Eyes again?" "Warts," Francis said. Giles faked a yawn. "Eyes." "I thought it was warts," said Francis. "Not ringworm," said Eamon. Giles sipped from his glass. "Eyes." "Sure it wasn't warts," said Francis. "In actual fact, it was eyes." From the way Francis held the curtain rod, I thought he might skewer Giles with it. This was the sort of Irish conversation that usually ended with one man hurling curses at the other. But this one wouldn't come to that. Francis was too gentle, and Giles was too professorial, so they sparred quietly. In their own way, they were a perfect match. They were like two people on opposite sides of a swinging door, both pushing to get entry through at once. Eamon finished eating a little bag of potato chips, turned the bag inside out, and busily licked at the salty paper. His mouth twisted madly off toward his ear as he licked. "They say holy water from those wells isn't supposed to boil," he said. "I tested it myself." "And what happened?" said Francis. "It boiled." "Course it did," said Giles. "But it's been known not to boil," said Francis. Giles said, "Nonsense," and stood up and found his way to the ancient wooden cigarette machine that hung on the wall. He was so blind he had to put his face up to the machine and walk his fingers across it, trying to find the coin slot. In his long poncho, he looked like a prophet. The pound coins he dropped into the machine fell to their destination with a heavy clinking thud. He pulled open one of the little wooden drawers and, finding it empty, he wrapped his arms around the machine as though preparing to lift it off the wall and gave it a mighty rattle. He punched the machine, peered at it, and punched it again. Francis watched him with a look of deep satisfaction and finally said, "'Tis broke." Giles returned to his seat. "I say, Francis, it would be quite easy to fix that machine, you know. It's a mere matter of a spring." Francis took 2 pound coins out of his pocket and made a show of reimbursing Giles. "That machine's next to 300 years old. No point fixing it." "But that is impractical," said Giles. Ireland is impractical, said Francis. This next bit is from the chapter called The True Face. The city of Dublin is crowded with churches. At the turn of the hour, church bells ring out from every direction, their various tones crossing and colliding, confusing the listener. Some begin a minute too early, some a minute too late, rendering the ringing interminable and the hour unclear. During the 6 months I spent in Dublin, I lived in a one-room apartment in a converted Georgian house on Waterloo Road. The apartment was like a waiting room in a dentist office, a dissolute dentist who had few patients and no assistant to help him. The ceiling was cracked and the walls, graced with billowing brown and yellow water stains, looked like a nautical chart. My furniture was an armoire, a lamp, and a couch that folded out into a bed. The mattress was the thickness of a paperback novel and had molded itself to the narrow shape of the person who lived there before me. The wall-to-wall carpet, roughly the color of brains, was frayed and worn. The best thing about the place was its proximity to three neighborhood churches, the sound of whose bells drifted through my window each morning, wakening me and reminding me again of the importance of religion in Ireland. Religion was as pervasive as the currency. It was everywhere. It was embedded deep in the Irish mind, and that seemed most evident in the way Irish people bless themselves as they pass by a church, an instinctual flutter of the right hand as they studied the headlines of the newspaper they had just bought, or scolded a disobedient child, or made a conversational point to a companion. Sometimes the fingers moved, twitching above the sternum, or passing absently over the face in a barely perceptible wiping motion. Riding in a Dublin bus, I was often gripped by an eerie disorientation at the moment the bus passed by a church I was never quick enough to notice, and I glimpsed in the periphery of my vision 30 hands flying up the air in similar fashions. On the streets, teenagers' hands leapt reflexively at the sight of a church, and then, driven by embarrassment, the hands would inevitably detour to the hair and pat it down, or to an eye to remove a non-existent cinder. Young people didn't want to be seen to be religious or to be identified with the lack of sophistication that religion had come to signify, but they were unable to rid themselves of the habit. Even red-faced schoolboys could not help raising a hand and passing it absently across their noses as they ran by a church, hurling curses at each other. The gesture was as ingrained and superstitious as the national pause for the Angelus. One of Dublin's distinctions is that it is the birthplace of the Legion of Mary, an international Catholic organization of great power and influence that grew out of a small informal meeting on Francis Street in 1921. I had heard of the Legion long before I ever set foot in Ireland, had seen it in operation in the United States and in China, but I knew little about its purpose, and it wasn't until I began seeing regular notices in the Irish Times about Legion meetings that I took an interest. The notices always said, "The Legion of Mary presents the true face of the Catholic Church, Pope John the 23rd." The idea of the true face interested me, for at times it seemed difficult to know what the true face of the Church was amid its many politically motivated distortions. The notices listed the various places Legion meetings were held each week, including Myra House at 100 Francis Street. This was the address at which Frank Duff had started the Legion of Mary 70 years before, so I chose to attend that meeting, although on any given night I could have attended five others in the city. As I walked across the city to Francis Street the next Monday evening, I passed a young girl playing a tin whistle on O'Connell Bridge. The girl was skinny and long-limbed, with red lips, a pretty face, and scraggly black hair that hung to her waist. She seemed oblivious to the 5 o'clock crush of pedestrians that jostled her from all sides. She held the whistle to her lips and blew violently into it. The whistle squealed out 3 wild notes, and the girl responded with a little jig of delight. She twirled in place with 1 leg held up in the air, and in 1 swift motion she spun round and gave a nearby drunk a spontaneous thump in the rear end with her sneakered foot. She howled with laughter at that, pleased by her own unpredictability. She spun again, hair swirling gracefully about her shoulders like the ribbons of a maypole, eyes ablaze with excitement. She hopped, turned, and panted into the whistle, and then, caught up in the momentum of her own soaring spirit, she wound up and flung the whistle into the Liffey. The whistle rocketed high into the pale evening air and came down, piercing its way into the river, tip first and without a splash. The girl clasped her dirty hands over her mouth, little bubbles, remnants of her own breath, rose to the surface as the whistle sank to the bottom. Slowly the girl's hands descended to her sides, and her good cheer dwindled visibly as she realized that her whistle was gone for good. This last little piece is from the chapter called Annie McNamara. I offered Annie a cup of tea, which she declined, preferring to stay with the bourbon. I made the tea anyway, put a mug of it down on the table beside her, and sat in a chair. When I told Annie in what style Willie and Baba had departed, she sat up and reoriented herself by staring methodically at the 4 walls with a blank look on her face, as though she had just sneezed. Then, dryly, she said, "Don't mind them two, my friend. They're both tick. 'Tis better that way. If they had any brains, they'd be dangerous." Annie crossed her legs, swung her foot, and looked curiously about the room. "Bob Brown," she said wistfully. "How well I remember him. Oh, he was lovely, and he loved my mother. He used to always be coming to our house, visiting her and bringing her gifts. They talked themselves blue in the face. It's weird they ended up 2 doors down from each other."
"2 doors down?"
"In the graveyard. Bob is buried 2 doors down from my mother. They were great friends. Oh, my poor mother. She's only dead a year. Where's your mother, Rose? Dead?" The question surprised and scared me a little. "No, she's not dead," I said. "Yeah, but you said nothing about her." I hadn't had a chance to say anything about her. Annie pulled a lock of her dark hair across her lips and stared incisively at me.
"What's your mother like? Nice?"
Her keen gaze made me uncomfortable. This was the first time anyone in Corfin had asked me anything about myself, and I realized with a small shock that Annie herself was like my mother. When I said that, Annie looked pleased, then suddenly displeased, and without sarcasm or jest, she said,
"A drinker, you mean?" "My mother was a drinker. Yes, all the time drunk. We'd be finding the bottles here and there. We'd be pouring them out, and she'd get more some way or another."
"Did your mother drink in the pubs?" I asked.
"Are you crazy? Women that age want to drink in the pubs. The men always say they don't like the women in the pubs because women would be fighting. I think that's too funny. Isn't it always the men fighting and arguing and having to be better than each other in the pubs? I don't know what men are talking about. Women are the peaceful ones. They keep the peace, like." Oh, but Jesus, women can be the shit. "Well..." Annie hung her head and laughed a long time about that. Her words reminded me of Molly Bloom saying, "It'd be much better for the world to be governed by the women in it. You wouldn't be seeing women going and killing one another and slaughtering. When do you ever see women rolling about drunk?" And adding in the same long-winded breath, "You
We are a dreadful lot of bitches. Annie had picked up a pencil and was idly knotting a lock of her hair around it. She said, "My mother was not happy, you see. Too many kids, for one thing. Once she confessed to the priest that she didn't want to sleep with my father anymore because she didn't want another kid, and the priest roared at her to get out of the confessional and do what she was put on earth to do. 'Twas her job," he said. That's how they think. But that's not what they said to me. I had a child, and they made me give him up because I wasn't married. They made me. I had other children. But that one, where is he? I'd like to know that. That is what I would like.
This is East End, Inc. Finally, Sag Harbor's Terry Sullivan led the gathering in Gaelic song.
There's a strong tradition of satire in Irish prose and song, often aimed at the systemic brutality of the British crown, whose emperor had no clothes. On this side of the pond, the Catholic Church picked up the cudgel of cruelty, identifying with the oppressor that punished them from the cradle to the grave. Both of these institutions insisted on silence in response to abuse. Think of how the Catholic Church covered up the abuse of so many children by everyone agreeing to a deadly silence. Satire answers that silence loudly with my first song, "Whatever You Say, Say Nothing." Whatever you say, say nothing. When you talk about you know what, for if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off to you know where, and you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. Now you all know who I'm speaking of when I mention you know who. And if you know who should hear you, you know what he'll do. So if you don't see me again, you'll know why I'm away. And if anyone told you where I am, here's what you must say. Whatever you say, say nothing. When you talk about you know what, or if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off to you know where, and you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. Now you all know what I'm speaking of when I mention you know what, and I fear it's very dangerous to even mention that, for the other ones are always here, although you may not see. And if anyone asks who told you that, please don't mention me. Whatever you say, say nothing. When you talk about you know what, for if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off to you know where, and you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. Now that's enough about so-and-so, not to mention such-and-such. I better end my song now. I've already said too much. For the less you say and the less you do, the less you'll go astray. And the more you do and the more you say, the more you'll hear them say. Whatever you say, say nothing. When you talk about you know what, for if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off to you know where, and you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you sing this song. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you sing this song.
Or oh, shedabahawallah. Or oh, shedabahawallah. Or oh, shedabahawallah. Anish erhyak unsaurig. Shedabahavan belainva. Bayer grak.
to the Ingeven, de Kivrai shell of mail yak, us to deal to lesh na gaula, or roche da va hawala, or roche da va hawala, or roche da va hawala. Anish erhyak on saurig Tagranu eleg choktor salya Ogligarum hale magarda Gaelid fein es na goil no spanig Es queer shud diger gauliv Oro shenaba hawalla Oro shenaba hawalla O Roshe Naba Hawala Anish Ehyat Un Sauri Avui Lari Na Vier Gavekin Monami In Bio In Eo Yak Shakten Granuel Esmilia Gashkyok Heg Fogart Foiner Gauliv Oro she da ba walla, oro she da ba walla, oro she da ba walla. Anish erhyak on saori, oro she da ba walla, oro she da ba walla.
This is East End Inc. We heard a portion of the annual Sag Harbor celebration of Ireland and Irish culture produced by Canio's Cultural Cafe of Sag Harbor. The complete program is available at moreeastendinc.blogspot.com. Upcoming literary events on the East End include on Saturday, April the 9th at 5 p.m. at Canio's Book Sag Harbor, a celebration of Lawrence Ferlinghetti with special guests Fred Gardiff and George Wallace, plus poets Bart Malio, Heidi Rain, and Tom Oleschuk, among others. East End Inc. is heard on the fourth and occasional fifth Wednesday each month. Starting next Wednesday, East End Inc. will be heard at 8 p.m. The programs are archived at moreeastendinc.blogspot.com. The podcasts are at soundcloud.com. Simply search for East End Inc. Today's East End Inc. was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Marianne Calendrill and Catherine Soga.
Oro she da ba ha walla, anish yat un saurig.